This description of a Buddhist Tonglen meditation is adapted from the writings of Pema Chodron. Please continue to breathe in and out naturally as you listen to these opening words. I don't want anybody hyperventilating. And then we'll actually try it in a minute. You are welcome to close your eyes. When anything difficult arises, any kind of conflict, any notion of unworthiness, anything that feels distasteful, embarrassing, or painful, instead of trying to get rid of it, we breathe it in. We would usually think of these poisons as something bad, something to be avoided, but that isn't the attitude here. Instead, they become seeds of compassion and openness. When suffering arises, the Tonglen instruction is to let the storyline go and breathe it in. Not just the anger, resentment, or loneliness that we might be feeling, but the identical pain of others who in this very moment are also feeling rage, bitterness, or isolation. We breathe it in for everybody. This poison is not just our personal misfortune, our fault, our blemish, our shame. It's part of the human condition. It's our kinship with all living things, the material we need in order to understand what it's like to stand in another person's shoes. Instead of pushing it away or running from it, we breathe it in and connect with it fully. We do this with the wish that all of us could be free from suffering. Then we breathe out, sending out a sense of big space, a sense of ventilation or freshness. We do this with the wish that all of us could relax and experience the innermost essence of our mind. So let's try it out now. I'm going to also invite you to return to this breathing practice with your eyes either open or closed at any time throughout the rest of the service. And I'll ring the bowl at the end as we transition into the talk. Think of anything about yourself that makes you feel lonely. Remember the identical pain of others who in this very moment are also feeling this same rage, bitterness, or isolation. Let's all breathe it in together for everybody. When we breathe out, we send out a sense of big space, a sense of ventilation or freshness. We do this with the wish that all of us could relax and experience the innermost essence of our mind. At your own pace, continue to breathe in and breathe out. This is not just our personal misfortune, our fault, our blemish, our shame. It's part of the human condition. It's our kinship with all living things in this room, in this community, in this world. It is the material we need in order to understand what it's like to stand in another person's shoes. Instead of pushing it away or running from it, we breathe it in and connect with it fully. We do this with the wish that all of us could be free of suffering. Why aren't there more young people at church? I hear this question a lot. I have given the matter some serious thought. I've read books and blogs, joined Facebook groups, and watched YouTube videos. gone to workshops, and had animated late-night conversations, all in an attempt to understand why there aren't more young adults at church. As I'm regularly the only young adult in the room when this question is asked, I often feel an obligation to take a bumbling try at responding. But today I'm going to share with you my dark secret. The real answer is, I don't know. I have some half-formed notions and guesses, but I just don't know why there aren't more young adults at church, or what we should do about it. Church nerd is a wonderful phrase I heard Rev Shawnee use once. That's me, I thought to myself. Most of my peers are happily spiritual but not religious, with no impulse to go to church. I'm different than other young adults because I am not just spiritual, but also religious. I am a church nerd. And herein lies the basic paradox of asking anyone who actually goes to church why people like them don't go to church. If you are interacting with us young adults at church, you can assume that we are so interested in going to church that we actually do it. This means that we are not necessarily going to be able to explain to you why most other young adults don't go to church. In this way, we are just not like those others. So being a young adult at church has sadly not resulted in me devising a simple 10-point action plan that sees Unitarian Universalism achieve world domination this century. Let's be really honest here. I'm not even sure if our faith will survive for the rest of my own lifetime. But as a young adult at church, I have received the gift of experiencing what it feels like to be different than those around you. Here's what I have come to believe to be true about being different. Such fields as evolutionary psychology and behavioral economics, among others, have taught me that our minds are hungry for difference. We have an innate drive to categorize and judge and organize our world. The categories we come up with are like shortcuts that break the world up into manageable chunks to allow us to make sense of what is going on, so that we can make decisions and function. There is nothing inherently bad about this human characteristic to categorize, but it is deeply powerful. And like most powerful things, it can do serious damage if we are careless. We are each different in a lot of ways all at once. I have crooked teeth, I cycle, my favorite color is blue, the list goes on. Trivial or profound, each characteristic makes me different from some and the same as others. Ignoring or celebrating differences, emphasizing similarities across difference, these are all valid options in various circumstances with both strengths and weaknesses. But no matter what, there is no magical option that simply makes difference disappear. We are all responsible for the choices we make about how we respond to difference. Let's use my young adult identity as a bit of a case study of some of the issues that come up when people are different. While the details may not be the same, I'm hoping that some of my general observations will resonate. After growing up unchurched and then becoming a UU nearly a decade ago in my mid-20s, I've only recently settled into being seen by others as a young adult at church. As an oldest child, I'm used to acting old and being seen by others as old. It feels just plain weird to be young. I don't think I'm alone in this. In churches like ours, without robust young adult programming and representation, young adults who strongly identify as young adults likely find church a lonely place. In these churches, young adults like me, who don't feel or act typically young, are probably more likely to find meaningful connection. I think I've witnessed a similar trait in some working class UUs from a non-mainline Protestant faith of origin, and other UUs who find themselves a minority of one flavor or another in our community. Depending on which way the demographic tides are turning, our differences can allow us to be early adapters that innovate and create space for others like us, Or we can remain few in number, fed by connections that are not based on finding other rare birds of our same stripe. There are those differences that are apparent to others, whether we want them to be or not. Other differences that are important may need to be disclosed. Regardless of how important a piece of someone's identity is, it is common to have people emphasize the parts of you they can see and minimize or dismiss other aspects that are less apparent. As much as we can manage, I encourage each of us to stretch ourselves, to let people be who they feel they want to be, rather than who we think we see. The ironic flip side for me of being branded a young adult, somewhat against my will, is that I've gotten used to being seen as special in this way. I've come to expect that people at church will remember me as that young woman, and to be confused with others at church younger than 50. That might be a slight exaggeration, but there have been a few cases. Now nearing the magic age of 35, at which my young adult status officially expires, I am preparing to retiring to being less special. I don't have kids, I don't make that much money, I don't have professional training that makes me a valuable church volunteer. As a boring old regular adult, I am not going to be that important. From healthy to disabled or mentally ill, from employed to jobless or retired, those of us here who've been through a change in identity where we move from being more valued to less valued know how transitory status can be. Throughout my young adult journey at church, I have often had this uncomfortable feeling that people see me as representative of all young adults. I feel the responsibility that I will say or do something that will influence church expectations of all people, 19 to 35. What will people assume about young adults if I speak too quickly, I miss a deadline, I lose my temper, or come up with a wacky idea that flops? It is hard to just be yourself when you feel like your actions reflect on a diverse group of people. This experience in our very loving community is the gentlest echo of the predicament of many of the social justice activists I've encountered in person and in writing. They want the freedom to be their unique individual selves and to not struggle under the burden of being seen to represent everyone who is different like them. I was exposed to these activists while completing a bachelor's degree majoring in English and women's studies. People have got English literature figured out, but I have fielded a lot of questions about women's studies. My stock answer is that it is an interdisciplinary field that comes out of the feminist movement and includes elements of various arts and social sciences, especially literature and film studies, sociology, history, psychology, and political science. So there's my stock answer. The more interesting thing that I often don't get a chance to share with others is that remarkably little emphasis was placed on the topic of gender in women's studies. Feminism was a lens that we used to examine such issues as class, colonization, the environment, sex, politics, and even religion, all with the broader goal of getting us to look again and again at the intersections in the web of life. The word systemic was our mantra. The commitment that feminism be not just about women was more core to the feminism that I studied than the fact that its origins came out of the struggle for women's rights. While classroom conversations were at times ludicrously theoretical and wordy, my studies were also deeply personal and transformative. We struggled with how very unfair life can be. We wrestled with how difficult it is to even figure out what is going on and what to do about it. We were challenged to resist band-aid solutions that would make us feel less personally uncomfortable, but did little to actually make things better. We learn that sometimes our role is to witness painful things and acknowledge that we do not fully understand them. Sometimes the challenge is to find a way to continue to not turn away from our discomfort. We were asked to take the risk of looking deeply and doing our best to really see things for what they were. This feminist training profoundly influences my view of religion and my expectations of our religious community. All of our individual identities are a web of connections to people that we share similarities with, people who are different like us. Though the differences between them are many, in my daily life, I'm startled by how profoundly a disabled client reminds me of my opa, my grandfather. My Australian friends have a lovely little daughter who speaks to her adored mommy and mama in her Canadian accent. None of us feel at home by virtue of being identical to those around us. There is always something that makes us stick out, that earns us praise or suspicion, or that we try to cover over to fit in. The flip side of this is that the most tenuous connection between otherwise very different people can be the source of deep relationship. So what do we in this room have in common? People of all ages and all faiths who attend worship in Canada are different together by the very fact that we even go to worship. While we may cringe to hear it, many unchurched will see no meaningful distinction between us and a Pentecostal. Indeed, if we look at the recent history of our faith, we have much more in common with mainline Christians than we are comfortable admitting. The statistics vary, but they all agree that regular religious attendance is practiced by well under half of Canadians. By attending worship, we are different than the majority of the people we will walk by on the street. And the general rule of thumb seems to be that the younger you are, the weirder you are for participating in organized religion. But perhaps not for the reasons you might expect. My belief in the supernatural or my choice of Unitarian Universalist spiritual tradition are not usually suspect among young adults. As a group, my peers embrace the value of spirituality. They go on Buddhist retreats, they incorporate Wiccan ritual into wedding ceremonies, they perhaps even crack open the Bible out of curiosity. But they balk at the idea of being involved in the organized part of religion. It is religion as an organized institution that I find myself defending to my peers. We actively crave the spirituality and community part of religion, but are dismissive, uncomfortable, and sometimes downright resentful about the organization, structure, and institution that sustain religion. It has become a truism that about half of young adults have experienced the failure of their parents' relationship. Less remarked on is that while few of us are marrying or having children in our 20s, most of my peers have experienced the end of a committed partnership. We expect the partnerships of those in their 20s to end. I don't support young couples remaining together at all cost, but this expectation that we will experience a series of failed committed partnerships has resulted in some psychological shifts in how we react to commitment. I think a fear of commitment to religious institutions is one part of these effects. Why risk wholehearted commitment when you expect that everything you allow yourself to care deeply about will eventually fall apart? If you fully commit, it will just hurt more. This theory is personal for me. Over the course of the year that I worked here in our church office in my late 20s, my long-term relationship ended. In not too recent history, being in a same-sex relationship, living common law, and separating would all have been sources of stigma for me. But I was luckier to live in a kinder reality. What I did feel shame about And what I worked hard to hide was how altered I felt by my grief at the ending of the relationship. A lot of my self-worth had been tied up in seeing myself as capable and level-headed. And I felt that was slipping away. I caught myself regularly staring out the window, bewildered and agitated. While I had loved her deeply, my split had been simple in many ways, and I reasoned to myself that others went through breakups all the time and managed not to fall to pieces. I would not forgive myself for being unable to just get over it. My self-judgment was harsh and relentless. I sometimes wonder if this mirrored my grandma's experience as she moved deeper into dementia. A very intelligent woman with a mind like a steel trap, I sensed her pain when she became disoriented. She felt she knew who she was and what she could do, and she disapproved of this new person she had become, with this shameful lack of ability to remember what she had for lunch yesterday. Most painful of all for me was that as I grieved my breakup, I believed in my bones that no one could understand my struggle to function. And yet I was surrounded by a religious community filled with people who shared my experience of moving from being part of a couple to being single. The irony is not lost on me. Some of them were even assertive enough to invite me over to tea and lovingly share their own stories of pain and loss. I likely could have found considerable comfort if I had let these people in. And yet I couldn't work up the courage to risk being vulnerable enough to admit how much of a mess I was. Sadly, for those experiencing such difficulties as addictions, bankruptcy, and abuse, they can realistically expect some negative judgment from others, which makes the process of stepping out of this loneliness to connect all the more challenging. I realize that this last story is a bit of a downer, and I'm happy to be able to honestly report that with some time, a lot of loving support from those around me, and a healthy dose of professional counseling, I feel a lot better today than I did then. I wish I could also report to you that I have conquered my tendency to get caught up in the belief that I am all alone in my struggles. I continue to resist the tendency to isolate. I work hard at opening up, but I am still unlikely to share with you at coffee time those parts of my identity that make me feel most vulnerable and alone. Even as I stand in a room surrounded by others who also carry loneliness and shame. It's a strange comfort to reflect that we are connected by this experience of feeling different. Knowing loneliness unites us at a deep emotional level that other more surface similarities don't match. It unites us with all people. Remembering that we feel different just like everybody else helps deflate that sense that we are alone. It nudges us to hope that reaching out is worth it and reminds us that we can find meaningful connection across difference. We can all be forgiven for looking around on a bad day and deciding that other people are all weird and that we ourselves are hopelessly flawed and will never fit in. Our church mission points us to a better option. Strengthened in spiritual growth, supported in community, energized by diversity. Energized by diversity is what I hope for all of us in this new year. So may it be, and amen.